Before we dive into today's discussion, we've got a special resource just for you, a free ebook called Does It Make Sense to Believe in God? In today's world, where faith is often labelled as outdated or irrational, this ebook takes a fresh look at the evidence for God. It features reflections from years of engaging with some of the world's leading atheists, like Richard Dawkins, and reveals why, after hearing every conceivable argument, our confidence in God's existence is stronger than ever. Download Does It Make Sense to Believe in God today for free at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, let's get on with today's show.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined, as ever, by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim, as ever. How long have we been doing this for? Quite a few years now, is it?
Approaching 3 years, I think. Is that right? 4 years?
I think it's 4 years.
4 years. Too long. Not long enough. You decide. Today's topic is hard to sum up in a single word. It's about power. It's about technology. It's about going back to the Bible and seeing if we've misunderstood power and technology. I'm going to hand over to you here, Dad. What are we talking about today?
Well, I think it's something that has been engaging my thinking and reading and study. And that is there a connection between what the Bible talks about in terms of principalities and powers, and the kind of power structures that we see in the world today, particularly my interest in artificial intelligence and technology. I'm trying to write at the moment about Christian responses to AI, and it seems to me that this issue about forces of power, including evil forces, is an issue which it seems in the modern church is rarely discussed.
Hmm. And already, I imagine some of our evangelical listeners are kind of recoiling in horror. Is John really about to suggest that the AI is actually Satan masquerading in code form? You know, this is kind of hysterical, unbiblical, overblown, kind of Pentecostal nonsense. What exactly are you proposing here? What are you trying to say? Calm people down.
Well, I think it's just, first of all, interesting just to sort of reflect on that kind of squeamishness which I sense about so many modern Christians. We want to take the Bible seriously, but actually, in reality, we want to airbrush quite a lot of what the New Testament has to say about forces of evil and about principalities and powers, because there is this immediate concern that it immediately is going to let loose in a kind of fanatical obsession with demons. Of course, C.S. Lewis said this. He said that we go to two extremes. Either we ignore the reality of evil completely, or we become overly fascinated by it. So what I'm trying to do is find what's the middle road? What's an appropriate understanding of evil in the modern world, whilst avoiding becoming completely fascinated and overwhelmed by it.
Because I think it's fair to say that a lot of, particularly evangelicalism, the kind of evangelicalism I was raised in, had a very strong sense that evil and sin and badness fundamentally came from us, from people, and that it was kind of either spurious or a massive kind of sidetracked to spend too much attention about people like the devil or kind of demons or spiritual authorities. But actually, the Bible is focused on our evil and how that can be fixed through the cross and resurrection and the gospel, and to start talking about other kinds of power that might be that's neither God nor humans is to kind of I guess to dodge the bullet, to kind of say, oh, nothing to do with me, it's just Satan did that, or, you know, whereas there's a strong sense that we need to be taking personal individual responsibility.
Yeah, I know, obviously there's an element of truth in that, but it's not the whole truth. And certainly, you know, if you take the Bible seriously, you take the New Testament seriously, as somebody put it, the language of power is written on every page. Sometimes it's human material power, but sometimes it's spiritual powers of evil. And not to engage with that and to say, how does that relate to the modern world? It seems quite wrong to me.
Hmm. And it's not just the New Testament, isn't it? You know, throughout the Old Testament, there are plenty of supernatural experiences that cannot be necessarily ascribed to God or to angels. You know, going back to, you think about the, you know, when Moses is having his showdown with Pharaoh, Pharaoh has these kind of magicians, these court magicians who are able to do some kind of supernatural, inexplicable things. Perhaps not quite as powerful as Yahweh God turns out to be, but clearly there are people throughout the Old Testament in the kind of biblical Hebrew scriptures, in that imagination, there's clear that they were, that there were spiritual powers, that there were forces that were malign and negative, that could do things that human beings cannot do, and that nobody kind of questioned or worried about that.
That's right. And also the Old Testament saw a connection between idols created by human hands becoming, again, sort of populated by evil spiritual forces. They didn't see human activities and hidden spiritual activities as kind of alternatives. They saw them often as working together. And I think as I've sort of read around this subject and reread the scriptures, what comes out to me is this: it's this idea that the Bible doesn't think in terms of dualistic categories. There are either material things, human things, or there are hidden spiritual things, and everything is either one thing or the other. Mm-hmm. The Bible doesn't think like that. The biblical worldview, as somebody's, as people have said, is as of a porous universe in which spiritual forces and human forces are intermingle and influence one another. And it's really only the Enlightenment mindset, or it starts with the sort of scientific, the rise of science, that starts to think in this very dualistic way, separating out material and human activities from spiritual activities.
And even our language, you know, the language of supernatural, as you say, is undergirded by a presumption of there is a distinction. There is the natural, and there are things that break the natural. And as you say, that's not really a worldview that chimes with the biblical authors, New or Old Testament, where clearly they thought that there were these powers and invisible forces that, as you say, were permeating the heavens and also the earth, and there wasn't really a strict divide between the two. And I think, as you say, it's often hard for us to think ourselves out, you know, go backwards past the Enlightenment, because this was, I think, commonplace up to probably the medieval era, certainly in the West. And, you know, and that's why I think historians, you know, like people might come across a historian, Tom Holland, who often, when he's on his very popular podcast, talking about kind of ancient or kind of early modern medieval history, you know, our instinct is always to say, well, they didn't really believe it, did they? Or that, you know, those superstitious medieval Christians or ancient Muslims or whatever it was thought X, Y, and Z. And he's always trying to reiterate to us moderns that actually they didn't have this distinction between there was the iron physical laws of the universe that even governed that, and then there might be a kind of God beyond that. They believed in a more holistic realm in which power flowed in lots of different directions in lots of different ways, and that was just completely kind of the air they breathed.
That's right. And that's definitely the way that the New Testament writers thought. And it seems to me that the accounts of the events in the Gospels leading up to the crucifixion are in many ways a really powerful illustration of the ways in which both human forces and spiritual forces are operating. So, I mean, if you just think about the human motivations that are involved in those, in the narrative in the towards the end of the gospel, leading up to the crucifixion. So, you've got Judas Iscariot, who is clearly just greedy for money. You've got Peter, who's a coward. You've got Pilate, who is clearly a weak and worried about a crowd baying for blood. You've got soldiers who are, you know, just acting in a very cruel and way. You've got the Jewish leaders, the chief priests, Herod, you know, all this, all very recognizably human motivations. But what the New Testament writers say is that actually there are spiritual forces at work at the same time. Mm. So it was Satan who enters into Judas Iscariot. And Jesus says Satan has asked to sift Peter like wheat. And when the mob come to arrest Jesus, he says, this is your hour and the authority of darkness.
Mm. And our response is to be like, well, does that means was Judas just a kind of sock puppet, an avatar of a demon? And he's not really responsible for his actions. You know, these human motivations are actually just kind of a fig leaf for a bigger, invisible spiritual fought battle between Jesus and demons. But actually, it seems like the New Testament writers say it's both and. It's not an either or. These human beings were all at work and were exercising their power and their intent and their will and their desires. And at the same time, there was a grand spiritual battle taking place between God the Father and God the Son. And on the other side, you know, Satan and demonic forces who are seeking to cause him harm.
That's right. So fallen human power and authority seems very often to be in lockstep with fallen spiritual powers, with powers and principalities. And it seems from the biblical material that these evil powers don't exercise independent agency. They operate through human beings. They amplify and magnify human brokenness, so that, as you say, trying to work out what exactly is a human contribution and what is some kind of spiritual evil becomes very difficult because the two are acting in lockstep.
Well, hang on though, but what about the Genesis narrative? The first representation of this kind of evil power would be the serpent in Genesis 3. The serpent doesn't seem to be very manipulative. Serpent doesn't seem to does seem to have some kind of agency. You know, Adam and Eve are merrily living their beautiful, perfect life, walking with God in the garden. And it's only when the serpent arrives that suddenly things start to go wrong. Is that not an example of the serpent exercising its own independent agency rather than just magnifying an already latent kind of evil desires within humans?
Well, it's a good question, but I mean, if we just think about it for a moment, so the serpent is there in the garden, but he doesn't sort of attack the humans physically. He doesn't push them over. He doesn't injure them, slaughter them, compel them. What does he do? He insinuates a thought into their minds.
Plants a seed.
He plants a seed, and the same we see the same with the temptations in the wilderness with. You know, the devil comes to Jesus, but they don't have a monumental fight like in The Lord of the Rings. You know, that's a kind of secular understanding, isn't it? You know, the forces of...
Harry Potter and Voldemort, you know, shooting their jets of different coloured light out of their wands in the Titanic showdown.
Yeah, or I was thinking of Gandalf fighting on the bridge, do you remember?
With the Balrog in the mines of Moria.
So it's titanic battles between good and evil. Well, I mean, there is some description of spiritual battles in the heavenly places, which is rather mysterious. But when it comes to human beings, the attack of the evil is through, as you say, through insinuation, through deception, through an idea.
Yeah. Deceit and manipulation and lies are really fundamental to how spiritual evil is manifest in the Old Testament and in the New Testament.
And so when it says Satan entered into the heart of Judas Iscariot, I think we can read that, not that there was some titanic sort of overwhelming of his will, but that it came through an idea. What about, why don't you do this?
Wouldn't it be nice to have a few more silver coins?
Absolutely. And, you know, how could you go about it? Yeah. Et cetera, et cetera.
And is the Bible clear about the kind of nature of these spiritual forces. There's lots of different language, you know, Satan, the devil, demons. Do we, you know, a lot of people would instinctively have a vague sense that these are kind of fallen angels. Is that what the Bible teaches?
Well, again, it's very interesting how, whereas the Bible is very clear about the nature of the goodness, the character of God, the, you know, the nature of the creation, and of human beings, and so on. When it comes to the origin of evil and the nature of evil, it seems that the Bible, the biblical narrative, is really quite opaque and confusing. It takes the reality of evil as very very definite and very real, but it doesn't talk about where that evil came from, at least not in a very clear and didactic way. And there seem to be two fundamental positions which Christian thinkers and commentators, theologians, have come to over the centuries. The first is that the evil is really just the negation of good. So God creates light, but the very existence of light means there's darkness. God creates order, but there is then the shadow side of chaos. God creates life, but the existence of life implies the possibility of death. So the negation of what God creates is fundamentally the nature of evil. It has no... So some people have argued, and Augustine is one of the people who is particularly associated with this view, that evil is just the lack of good. It has no fundamental reality in itself. But there is the other view, and that is perhaps the more traditional view, that Satan and evil forces are in fact fallen beings, fallen spiritual beings, and that preceding the rebellion on earth, there was a rebellion in the spiritual places, and therefore Satan rebelled against God, and he has a mass of fallen beings, spiritual beings, who are the sort of counterpart to the good angels.
And I guess this is all kind of wrestling with the idea that if everything seen and unseen, as the creeds have it, was created by God, then, and God only creates things that are good, how do you explain, as you say, the existence of evil beings? And one solution is that they were originally created good, just like humans were, but have chosen to turn their backs on God and to embrace evil, to embrace a different path. Though I suppose it then creates other questions about why they would do this and to what end. And I mean, it's always struck me as, you know, unlike human beings, angelic beings seem to have a clearer picture of the kind of spiritual realities that this world operates in. What possible incentive is there to oppose God if you are fully aware that Jesus is more powerful than you and you are going to be destroyed?
Yeah, and people have speculated that maybe that means that actually angels, although they can see present realities, they can't see the future. They don't know the future in the way that God knows the future. So, and we are given insight into that through the scriptures, but that's the only way we can know the future because of prophecy and so on. So the consequences of their rebellion was not something that was known to, if that's the case. I think the summary is that evil is real, that it's subordinate to God, as ultimately it's not an equal force. It's not that that God and evil are in a ultimate battle,
which is a very common kind of motif among kind of ancient Near East religious beliefs, wasn't it? That there was a series of competing gods, or sometimes even some of the surrounding kind of peoples of that part of the world where the Jews were living did have a very clear sense that there were two, you know, a good god and a bad god, and they were in constant battle, and the kind of fate of people and created order kind of rested on who was winning in the spiritual realm and that kind of thing. So it was a very that kind of dualism was a very common idea, and the Hebrews, the Jews, were very firm, Old Testament and then Christians even more so, that that is not the case, that there is a one true God who is supreme and powerful over all things, and is not, there is no threatening power, there is no counterbalance to him.
That's absolutely right. And of course, that was completely extraordinary within the ancient Middle East and Near East. So it was the uniqueness of the God of the Bible that he had total authority, which was a feature of, as you say, Judaism, and then Christianity took that on, and indeed Islam, and those three faiths stand out really against all other faiths, which have tended to see evil, good and evil, as in perpetual conflict.
And then in the New Testament, Paul in particular takes on this idea of the kind of supremacy of Yahweh God, and says actually it's all held in the person of Christ, and has that, there's a very famous passage in Colossians, isn't there, where it talks about Christ the firstborn over all creation, in him all things hold together, and angels and demons and the world and people and everything come under him, and he is the kind of pinnacle of power and authority, and that clearly in Paul's worldview also includes sundry demons and spiritual malign forces and Satan himself.
That's right. And I come to realize that that passage in Colossians 1 is incredibly significant in this sense, because what he's saying is that everything visible and invisible was created through Christ. It came into existence through the agency of Christ. They were created for his use. And ultimately, God's plan is going to reconcile all the powers, everything created, both spiritual and material, to himself through the cross. So the cross is central. Jesus' death on the cross is central to the ultimate reconciliation of all the powers under Christ's authority.
If that's the case, then I guess trying to discern when people like Paul and other New Testament writers talk about powers and authorities, you know, trying to figure out, oh, does he mean the Roman powers here, or the Jewish leaders, or, you know, the local king of this particular city or anything, or is he referring to demonic forces, is actually almost moot, because almost always the answer is probably both.
I think that's right. I think it's not completely right, because I think the interesting thing is there's a kind of dialectic between this wonderful passage in Colossians, there where Jesus is supreme over all the powers, and then you get Ephesians, and in particular Ephesians 6, which talks about the spiritual powers attacking and the need to have the full armor and the threatening power of evil. So we somehow have to live in this dialectic. You know, Paul somehow had that. You know, he wrote both these passages. And yet they seem almost contradictory. There's a kind of dialectic between them. And we live in that interface. And I came across this very nice analogy, which came from the Second World War, when what had happened was that by 1944, it was obvious the Allies were sweeping through Europe, and it was obvious that the Nazi forces were progressively losing. They had lost their fundamental authority. It was the Allies who could tell the Nazis where they could operate and where they couldn't. So the Allied forces set limits on how the Nazis operate, and that was a sign of their ultimate defeat. And yet, in 1944, there was horrific famine, particularly in the Netherlands, when millions of people were affected by famine from November 44 until the final victory in Europe in 1945. So there's a kind of analogy there that's our situation. Yes, the spiritual forces are ultimately defeated and limited by God's power, but they still exercise extraordinary agency.
And within the limits set by the superior power, that is God, or the allies in the analogy, that doesn't mean that they can't cause massive harm, real harm. You know, real people really died in the Netherlands in the winter of 44-45. And, you know, and I've read accounts, you know, after D-Day in the summer of 44, there was this immense excitement across all the countries that were occupied by the Nazis. They thought liberation was a matter of days, weeks away. And then suddenly it turned out that actually, even though the success of D-Day meant fundamentally, as you say, Hitler couldn't win and the end was certain, that doesn't mean that there wasn't lots of fighting left to do. And that, you know, there was even kind of like spontaneous outbreaks of kind of public uprisings that the Nazis then put down. And there was another, you know, 9+ months of grim German occupation to endure before, as you say, final victory in the following summer of 45. And we are living, as it seems, you know, in that winter. The victory is secure. We know that God and Christ is going to triumph over these powers and make his enemies a footstool and every knee will bow and all that stuff. But we're not there yet. And that doesn't mean that we can't significantly suffer from the activity of not just our fellow human beings, but also spiritual evil.
That's right. And this is also reflected in the book of Revelation, in the apocalyptic sort of scenes. You know, and again, controversial and not always clear how they can be interpreted. But what they show is, again, this titanic struggle going on between the forces of good and the forces of evil. But the saints are called to, you know, martyrdom, to patient endurance, to suffering. So the fact that the ultimate conquest of evil is to come doesn't mean that there isn't going to be terrible suffering along the way. And that's why we living in this period can't be kind of naive and sanguine about the suffering that may come if we are resisting the forces of evil.
As we approach the end of the year, I want to take a moment to reflect on the incredible work God has done through Premier Insight in 2024. This year, we've launched new podcasts like Rico Tice's and provided impactful books and resources, and we've shared the powerful N.T. Wright videos to help people grow in wisdom and share their faith with clarity and compassion. But this ministry wouldn't be possible without you. Your generosity has equipped countless believers to live out their faith. Right now, we face a $112,129 funding gap that must be closed by December the 31st to sustain this vital work. Your gift today will not only help us finish this year strong, but also lay the foundation for exciting plans we have for 2025. Visit premierinsight.org to give today. Together, let's make an eternal impact for God's kingdom. Thank you for your generosity. And now, let's get back to today's episode.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the theologian Karl Barth and his kind of interpretation of powers in the New Testament and what that implication might be about the New Testament's teaching on spiritual power and evil for our world today?
Yes, I found Barth's writing very interesting. I mean, I wouldn't go along with it 100%. Barth was certainly one of the theologians who shifted very much towards Augustine's idea that these forces didn't have any real spiritual reality. They were fundamentally forces coming out of the fallen human heart. But he described them as lordless powers, powers which come out of human hearts, but which can become uncontrolled and damaging. And he identified, interestingly, writing, you know, he wrote this just at the end of the Second World War in the 1940s, and he identified four powers of the modern world, which were, as he described them, lawless powers. And then very briefly, they were, one, the power of the state; two, the power of mammon, of money, of riches; three, the power of ideologies; and four, the material powers, and particularly technology. And so I think that's very prescient. I think those four powers are very much in evidence today. And what Karl Barth was arguing is that the forces of evil are liberated in these particular areas of modern society, and I've been trying to then think about AI and technology, digital technologies, and what struck me is that all four of those, the state, mammon, ideology, and technology, all four of those are very much in evidence in artificial intelligence and the rise of digital technologies.
And just before we get there, I think it's really interesting noting that Barth was writing in the, as you say, to end of the Second World War, in the 1940s. So it's just about where the Cold War is about to kick off. But actually, those four areas really became incredibly powerful and significant in writing the story of the second half of the 20th century, didn't they? Because you have the power of the state. You know, well, this is the point where the state starts to accrue enormous tax raising powers and developing technologies and things like that. You have the power of human ideologies. Well, this is an era divided between communism and capitalism, East versus West. You know, the entire world is captured in this kind of battle between ideas. You've got the power of mammon. You know, this is, you have an enormous burst, 30 years of economic growth and recovery after the crisis of the war that sees, you know, some of the richest countries we've ever seen. And you have the power of technology. Well, this is the era of the atom bomb and fiber optic cables and the invention of the computer and the internet. And our world is transformed by the power of the technologies and the material progress that human beings are making. So, remarkably insightful in the 1940s to be able to identify that actually power concentrated in these four areas is about to kind of remake people and remake the world in ways that fundamentally don't always seem in our control.
That's right. And really, Barth's vision is quite dark. So far from being a kind of optimist about these power sources of the modern world, I think coming from this biblical understanding of the powers, he sees the evil potential, the lordless powers that are not operating under the divine providential control, or at least, you know, they are rebellious, they are even anarchic. And certainly, you know, just fast forwarding to the present, you know, the extraordinary thing is really what has happened since the turn of the century, the beginning of the 21st century. If you looked, for instance, if you just took economic power, at the turn of the century, the most powerful companies, the economically powerful companies, were basically oil and mining giants. They were the extraction. They strutted the stage. They were far and away the most powerful companies on the planet. And fast forward 20 years, and all of those oil and manufacturing companies are now tiny non-entities compared to the growth of the tech giants. And
people might not quite realize just the extent to which that is the case. I mean, do you have any numbers just that underlie just how vast those kind of that handful of companies based in Silicon Valley are compared to your Exxon Mobils and your Shells of the yesteryear?
Yeah, so if you just work out what's called the market capitalization, so that's basically the share value and the number of shares of these different companies. And there are six companies: Apple, Microsoft, Nvidia, Amazon, Google, and Meta. And between them, they are worth $15 trillion. Apple is, and Nvidia, I think, are the biggest. They fluctuate slightly, but they're absolutely extraordinary amounts, the value that of them. The next, the largest oil company is ExxonMobil, and that has a market capitalization of $390 billion. In other words, only slightly more than a tenth of the value of Apple. And
these aren't just nerds anymore. These are the masters of the universe.
These are the masters of the universe. They have far more economic power than most countries. Yeah. You know, the market capitalization of Apple is greater than the gross domestic product of the UK, for example. You know, so just a single company sitting on that amount of money gives them extraordinary power. And as this has happened very rapidly, it's all due to the power of technology, and the way that the smart money is pouring in. So this is very much it's mammon, it's capitalism, but it's also ideology. It's got a this techno-optimist dream of creating a better world, of creating a super intelligence, of bringing in an era of plenty and prosperity.
And a dream which goes along with ultra low light touch regulation and kind of libertarian freedom for these companies and investors to pursue technology and its development as they see fit, unencumbered by the need to secure kind of popular consent from government or people for what they're doing.
That's right. And also state power. So these tech companies, are arguably controlling, exerting enormous force over the American state and also over European countries. They have massive lobbying power, and this is often called regulatory capture. That these companies, because of their power, are able to capture the regulatory authorities and ensure that their own interests are protected.
And then in the Chinese context, though, it's kind of opposite, because the Chinese tech companies, which we're maybe less familiar with, but they're no less wealthy or powerful in their own right, there's really no such thing as an entirely private independent company in the Chinese system. You know, they all have to various degrees negotiate with the Chinese Communist Party and the state there, knowing that at any point the government could decide to take it all away. And so the enormous economic and institutional power of the tech system in China is really a kind of extension of the power of the Chinese state, which is why America is getting so kind of worried about the geopolitical elements of this kind of clash of technology and the rise of AI and internet companies.
That's right. And one of the very striking things that's just happened just literally over the last 2 or 3 years is the way that a number of the tech giants who initially claimed that they were only going to do good and they weren't going to have anything to do with military and et cetera, that virtually without exception, all of the tech giants are now closely allied with the US military and are producing high-tech devices, software, artificial intelligence for military use. And that's because of this geopolitical competition between the Chinese state and ultimately the American power. We've now got a bipolar world, and technology is at the heart of those two competing interests.
I mean, look at some of the bills that the American Congress has been passing in recent years, often with bipartisan support from both sides of the aisle. It's things like, we want to ban TikTok because we think it's, you know, as a Chinese company having this much data on Americans' habits is dangerous. There's been, you know, massive tariffs placed on kind of Chinese technology to try and make it less affordable in the US, and also particularly huge state-led investment you know, kind of rolling back the years to the 50s and 60s, really, this kind of top-down state-led investment into building up America's ability to construct and manufacture chips and technology like that locally, rather than relying on Taiwan and South Korea and Chinese factories, believing that, you know, America needs to be a kind of technologically independent and not reliant on China or countries in its orbit to produce some of the most critical components that go into everything from cars to factories to weapon systems.
And I think we're going to see more of this with the new Trump administration, with Elon Musk now at the world's richest man, who is now in an extraordinary power of influence at the heart of American state. And not he's not alone. There are a whole number of other the tech bros, they call them, who are, you know, in enormous positions of influence with Trump, currying favor, ensuring that their own interests are being protected. So you know, then we go back and we say, okay, so we've got this biblical understanding of the powers, and how does that apply to this white hot heat of technology? Is it possible to see the operation of principalities and powers? And I think it is. And where we see it is that I don't think that any of the leaders of the American tech industry are purposefully malevolent, that they're going out of their way to do evil.
No.
But I think that they are often remarkably naive. There is a kind of combination of technical brilliance with moral and ethical naivety, which means that they are wide open to manipulation by evil forces. And, you know, there's a famous phrase by the statesman, Lord Alton, wasn't it, who said, "All power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely." And I think, why is that? Why is it that power corrupts? And I think the biblical answer to that is it's because of the principalities and powers. It's because of these hidden forces which amplify and exacerbate human brokenness and selfishness and pride.
And perhaps in a previous era, this corrupting, manipulative, hijacking spiritual forces of evil might have congregated around industries like, you know, nuclear power, which offers so much promise for humanity in terms of energy, and yet, as we know, ultimately came to be most primarily kind of used to build up absolutely staggering nuclear intercontinental ballistic missile arsenals so that we could wipe out the world 10 times over in a blink of an eye, the press of a button. And then today, you know, you see the potential of something like the internet, and you see it in the slightly kind of credulous naivety when you roll the clock back to the early 2000s, when companies like Facebook and Google were kind of making their mark. They had a kind of almost childish naivety about what they thought they were doing and what they were unleashing. You know, Mark Zuckerberg famously said, you know, "We just want to connect people." And, you know, and Google said, "Our mission statement is to organize the world's information, you know, and not be evil." And then today, these are companies that, with no one person deciding to kind of steer them in this direction, have become repositories of, like, as you say, concentrations of unprecedented power that's often been used to cause enormous harm. You know, we've talked about previously the ways that, you know, Facebook and Instagram have, you know, devastated people's mental health, helped whip up pogroms and intercommunal conflict and civil wars. No one set out to do this. You know, when the nerds in Silicon Valley or in Harvard set out to, you know, coded up the first versions of these websites, and they had no intention of doing this. And yet, as power accumulated around the technology, so did potentially, you're arguing, kind of spiritual forces that took it in an unprecedented direction.
That's right. And, you know, and I think the same is already beginning to happen with artificial intelligence. That's not to say that there aren't extraordinary positive benefits of it. And I'm certainly not opposed to this technology on principle. But I think we must beware of the kind of naivety that thinks with this extraordinary economic power, with this technological brilliance and the ability to manipulate, I mean, what the modern generative AI systems above all have is an ability to persuade and manipulate and confuse human beings.
Mm.
And also they have this extraordinary hidden nature that in that even the engineers who designed them couldn't tell you exactly why it was producing that particular text output.
Mm.
And I suspect just as we've seen a sort of epidemic of negative impact of social media, you know, it's only a matter of time before we see an epidemic of the negative impacts of generative AI, artificial AI companions, you know, deep fakes, various kinds of manipulative evil is going to pour out. I think a Christian understanding would say there are mysterious forces of evil that are going to and are currently amplifying this human tendencies towards evil.
I was struck by, you know, when we were talking a while ago about Augustine's understanding of this and how he saw evil as this kind of the privation of good. And in that worldview, kind of evil is fundamentally parasitic on the good things that God has made. And it struck me that generative AI is also fundamentally parasitic on creation. You know, it can't make anything new itself. It's just ingested so much stuff that we have made that it can produce a kind of surprisingly impressive kind of facsimile of it, whether that's images or text or anything else. It's not it's parasitic on the hard work and creativity of real human beings and produces this kind of shadow version of it, which is beguiling and alluring, but potentially I would suggest fundamentally a little thin and unsatisfying in comparison to the real deal.
Well, I think that's right, and I think it is completely parasitic on human intelligence. Now, I think it's still an open question of how far it can go in terms of creating new insights, new understanding, quotes, new forces. We don't know, but I think what we're called to do as Christians is to unmask the powers, look, identify them, unmask them, name them, and then I think to engage the evil powers, you know, again, as in Ephesians chapter 6, in this image of spiritual warfare, or the other, you know, the phrase, resist the evil one and he will flee from you.
Just before we get, you know, knee deep in that conversation, I imagine some people listening to this are saying, well, hang on, John, calm down. You're getting a bit carried away here. Do we need to hyper-spiritualize and over-theologize this? Or is it a simple example of human beings are broken and fallen, sinful people, and so given a new technology, they will inevitably use it in for sinful ways, and it's just an extension of our own, you know, fallen natures? We don't need to come up with kind of complex spiritual architectures about demonic forces and all this stuff. It's just simple of, you know, technology is a tool, can be used for good or evil. And in this case, human beings tend to be evil. And so they use this new tool, this new power we've constructed for us for evil. Is it any more, does it need to be any more complicated than that?
Well, and I would say twofold. Number one, evil is never simple. I mean, we talked before about another naivety. There is a sort of stonking naivety about many of the tech leaders, but I'm afraid to say there is also a similar naivety amongst many Christian believers who have this sort of simplistic understanding of the nature of evil. And I just want to take the biblical narrative seriously. Yes, of course, we have to try and translate it, interpret it in the light of the present. And as we said earlier on, you know, this is a kind of pre-modern understanding of the cosmos. And we're trying to relate that into the world of tech, which is, you know, this sort of the height of late modernity, really. And yet, I think that biblical perspective of that evil is far more mysterious and complex than you might think. I think that has a better explanatory force, a way of understanding the modern world, a way of understanding these tech developments, than a kind of simplistic sense that it's just a few human beings making some bad choices. I mean, the phrase that is often used by the tech world themselves is bad actors. You know, what they say, the implication is the majority of us are jolly good, decent, ordinary kind of people who want to do good. But there's a few bad actors out there. Mm. And what we've got to try and do is resist the bad actors and just enable everyone else to get on doing good. Mm. And of course, we don't see it like that. That is so naive and simplistic. Mm. Evil is much more complex, much more multifaceted.
And the kind of tech world's solution to the harms caused by things like social media is basically, we'll just hire a team of moderators and they can just work their way through the tiny small percentage of posts that are bad, so that cause harm, and we'll moderate those and delete those away, you know, ignoring the harm caused to our moderators in the process, but that's by the by. And we all carry on. And actually, it's fundamentally insufficient, because I think as is becoming increasingly apparent to everyone, these platforms themselves and the way in which the technology works, the internet works to amplify and connect people, and the algorithms work, are themselves fundamentally problematic, and they tend towards amplifying the worst in us. It's not just a question of find the 1%, as you say, of bad people doing bad stuff online and cut them out and everything is fine. It's more complicated. And I think this points to the fact that this kind of instrumentalist view of technology, that it's just a neutral tool that just simply reflects the motivations of the person behind it, as you say, is quite naive and fails to understand that actually the things that we make and the things that we use in this world can have a tendency towards something else. You know, the example I often think about is, you know, that famous line, you know, guns don't kill people, people kill people. You hear it a lot from the kind of gun rights lobby in the US. But actually, fundamentally, while of course you can do good with a gun, guns are not an entirely neutral tool. They have a tendency towards death and destruction, because that's baked into their very being, as to, you know, fire bullets that cause enormous damage to whatever they hit. And a gun can just lying around does not simply reflect the good or bad people around them, but it draws negativity and destruction out of people. And in the same way, I think we have to be scrutinizing new technologies, up to and including AI, to think about not just instrumentally how do we use them, but also what are they doing to us? How are they using us as we use them? What are they bringing out of us? What are they nudging us towards in subtle, unnoticed ways?
Yeah, and another way of talking about this is using the phrase structural evil, that evil is not just within individual human hearts, but evil can pervade structures, and the structures which we are particularly concerned of are the digital technologies and AI structures now, the structures being created by these enormous locuses of power, and asking the question, you know, to what extent are those structures capable of having evil consequences? And I think the biblical perspective just adds another perspective on that, because again, the implication is, if only we can get the good structures, everything's going to be fine. You know, we just need to replace bad structures with good structures. We need to replace bad technology with better technology, and then everything will be fine. Whereas the biblical perspective says, no, there is a fundamental evil at loose in the cosmos, and therefore we should be looking out to it, identifying the activities of evil, and then seeking to oppose it. And ultimately, I think the biblical perspective is how can these powers be redeemed? It seems that the demonic powers can never be redeemed. I mean, certainly if we take the apocalyptic, you know, in Revelation, that perspective is ultimately those evil forces are judged and destroyed in the lake of fire. But I think that the human elements of powers can be redeemed by God's grace. And that's really the story of the gospel. And it's the story of the cross, that the cross is far wider than individual salvation from the effects of sin, which of course it is, from the consequences of sin. But it's also good news for society. And it seems to me that is the question which we're all going to have to wrestle with, is it possible for this technology to be redeemed, to be brought back out of the control of evil and used for genuine good, for human flourishing and for the purposes of the gospel?
But to scale back for a second, you know, if your kind of thesis is that as Christians in the church, we need to be much more alive to how power works and to concentrations of power, and expect in places like AI and the enormous power and wealth of the tech industry and modern digital technology, we should expect spiritual evil forces to be kind of gravitating towards that, to be in operation there, because that's what the Bible tells us. Therefore, should we therefore be much more skeptical about modern digital technology? You know, you talk about redeeming it, but surely the best thing to do is to flee from it, like the Bible says, to flee from where we see these concentrations of spiritual evil. You know, we had Andy Crouch on this podcast a few months ago telling us about how he and many other Christians are trying to kind of have a complete fire break between screens and the internet and social media and smartphones in their families. Should the church not be doing something like that, rather than riskily trying to dabble their toes and redeem it?
Well, it's many complex issues there, isn't it? I think the question about families and raising children is one particular issue, and I think we're all much more aware now of the possible negative consequences that the children have from exposure to harmful digital technology, particularly social media, smartphones, and so on. So I think I'm very much supportive of the kind of initiatives that Andy Crouch and others are taking to try to limit the impact of digital technologies on the developing human beings that we are responsible for. But that's different from saying, as an adult, you know, if you're going to work in the modern world, by definition, you're engaging with digital technologies constantly. I mean, I think
But can we do that without collaborating unintentionally with these malign spiritual forces that are clustering around it and driving it forward in harmful ways?
Well, that's always the case, isn't it? Because the same is true for other concentrations of power. You know, can I pay my taxes without in some way collaborating with evil forces within the state? You know, can I, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is the human condition. But the Christian perspective is not to despair and fatalism, but is to say, going back to Colossians, that ultimately these powers are defeated, that we are called to resist and to be agents for change, agents of hope. And we believe it is possible for technology to be redeemed.
Hmm. So I guess the real calling here is, to coin a phrase, the church needs to stay woke in the original meaning of that word, in terms of be awake, be alert, be alive, have your eyes wide open to how, you know, ChatGPT is not just a totally harmless, interesting kind of technological eccentricity, but is potentially the harbinger of something more harmful.
And that we shouldn't, we shouldn't be naively using it to prepare sermons and Bible studies.
Right, but and produce our liturgies.
Because there are deeper forces at work, and these things need to be redeemed.
But at the same time, retreating into our kind of tech-free bubbles, you know, turning our back on the internet and AI is not necessarily a problem-free solution either.
Well, I just don't think it's an option. Well, at least it's a very radical option. Even the Amish in America don't abandon all technology. They use some pretty sophisticated technology. They're just very selective in how they use it. And I think we've got things to learn from groups like that. I think that there is a strong element of pragmatism in many of us, and including in the Christian churches, which just say, well, you know, why not? It seems to help. And I'm, you know, and I think having this deeper, more nuanced understanding of spiritual evil, I think helps to counterbalance that.
I guess it's asking the question, you know, is this technology, is this power that I am engaging in, is it pushing for dominance and to dominate, or is it able to serve, and can it be used to serve as opposed to, or will it start to dominate me, and will it allow me to dominate others? Because that's always, you know, what these spiritual powers seek to do. And we see throughout the Gospels, what does Jesus do when he comes across spiritual power? He expels it to liberate the person it was dominating, you know, whether that's Legion or any other person he encounters quite literally possessed by spiritual evil, taken over. The force of the gospel is to liberate, so that person is free once again to pursue life in all its fullness as a creature of God, living in service to him and a greater power.
Yes, and we probably don't want to go into that in any great depth, but I think we should just point out the relationship with this and the safeguarding scandals that the church has been beset by, which again is about the abuse of power.
Yeah.
It's about individuals who are exerting enormous personal power in a spiritual religious context, and yet who ended up perpetrating really remarkable evil.
Yeah.
And then the question comes, well, how did that happen? And again, I think that this perspective shows you that wherever there is power, there is danger. And therefore, what we need within the church and within society is the godly use of power, power that is used in a godly, discreet and thoughtful way, which reflects the way in which Christ himself exercised power.
Yeah, and that's ultimately the model that we have to keep coming back to. You know, Jesus was the most powerful person who ever lived, and yet none of his power was used to dominate, to bully, to domineer, to overcome, to impose himself on others, but to serve and to love and to liberate and to uplift and to protect. And that's the shape of how we need to be exercising whatever power we might have, or whatever power we might be gleaning from new technologies. Shall we call it quits there? That's been going for an hour or so. Lots to chew on. Thanks very much for listening, everyone. I hope you found that interesting. We'd love to know your own thoughts. Do get in touch with us, Molad. You can email molad@premier.org.uk. Do you disagree with us? Are there other things we should be considering in this conversation? And also, more generally, what suggestions might you have for topics we could discuss in future episodes, or new developments in science and technology and ethics and culture that we should respond to. There's lots of other resources on Dad's website. That's John Wyatt, WYATT.com. You can find some of my journalism on my website, TSWyatt.com. And otherwise, we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.